It's Mexican professional wrestling. And if you are not familiar with it, you are in for a special treat tonight on Extreme Championship Wrestling.
From Television City in Hollywood.
This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
The following wrestling exhibition requires discretionary viewer participation.
Greetings from Allentown is taped in front of a live studio audience.
And welcome to episode 87 of Greetings from Allentown. I am your host, Peter Winson. And today, in a bit of a swerve, bro, for episode 87, I'll be taking a look at ECW Hardcore TV from September 26, 1995. This would be ECW Hardcore TV number 127 on your award-winning WWE network. And you're saying, why? You promised me January 1, 1984, AWA. And I would have liked to have delivered that, except a couple of things happened. Unfortunately, for those of you who like to watch wrestling on YouTube, as I do, along with the award-winning WWE Network, I do sprinkle that in as well. You'll notice a lot of stuff went away over the past week. For those of you who even frequent the Greetings from Allentown playlist of shows that I've reviewed, it is now a complete mess of... Most of the videos now say deleted by user or deleted something. So it'll just skip over most of it. And along with that was the AWA show that I had intended to do, and I did not download it first and make a copy of it, which I thought that I had, as well as the show I was planning to do next week and the show that I was planning to do the week after that. So when thinking about it over the weekend, I said, you know, why don't I try a show off the network and see how it goes? Because I generally prefer to do shows off YouTube, in part because I'm not exactly the most technologically savvy guy in order to pull clips from the network. You'll notice that the clip at the top of the show was a little bit tinny, I guess. I reached out to Joe Murata of the Our Vantage Point podcast for a little bit of advice, and he did give me some hints to maybe get the sound a little bit better. But there may not be as many in-show clips. Of course, now that I say that, there'll probably actually be more of them, because with this being an ECW show from before I actually started watching in 1997, I may need some help from the announce crew, which would be Lonely Joey Styles. Imagine that, doing a wrestling show by yourself. To explain certain things that are going on that I might not have understood because it wasn't particularly well covered back in the day. But first, let me get in my plugs. You can email the show, greetingsfromallentown@gmail.com. Always love that positive feedback via email. Facebook.com/greetingsfromallentown. Give me a follow on Twitter, @GFAllentownPod. And you are probably listening to the show on the Pro Wrestling Only feed. More on our friends at Pro Wrestling Only later. And I am scheduled to be making an appearance, a guest appearance, on fellow Pro Wrestling Only feed podcast, Lucha Afterground. And they're actually winding up their fourth season. And it is going to be a very interesting experience for me because I have never actually watched an episode of Lucha Underground. So, again, you know, I'll kind of be coming in with a bit of a fresh take. And the word is that the episode that we'll be doing may be the last episode of Lucha Underground. I know I've heard that in the past. I think I remember hearing that after season 2, and they had a season 3 and season 4. It would be kind of weird if I only watched the last episode of Lucha Underground and none of the other ones. It would be the exact opposite of Beverly Hills 90210 during its original run, where I watched the pilot of that show and then I never watched a single episode for the next 10 years as it continued its run. So anyway, I didn't do a lot of wrestling watching over the weekend because I was mourning all my lost videos. In fact, I was doing more searching for new stuff that's out there and also downloading things to find backups for future weeks. I actually do have a plan for next week that is tentative and is also non-WWE and non-WCW. And obviously, I'm not going to do two ECW shows in a row. It's certainly an interesting experience typing up the notes for this one. And yes, I actually said typing up the notes, and a bit of a change for me, not only pulling a show from the network, but I actually typed my notes like a person who is living in the year 2018 instead of writing it all down in a notebook. I don't know how I feel about it. I'm going to give it a go, but it felt different. I didn't feel like I was writing jokes as freely. It almost felt like I was writing stuff just sort of straight up. So, I don't know. When I get through with this, I'll listen back and I'll kind of judge and I'll make changes accordingly. Oh, before I forget, quick shout out to Place to Be Nation friends over there. I'll actually be on the Place to Be podcast the next episode that comes out the first week of November. So I think it'll be on that Monday night or on Tuesday, Election Day. You will probably wake up to that in your podcast catcher or whatever, covering the Saturday Night's Main Event from October of 1988. And if you need a clue what that one is, that is the Jake Roberts, Andre the Giant, Snake Gives Andre a Heart Attack angle. So do keep that in mind a few weeks down the road. As I was saying, a lazy weekend for me. I used a leaf blower for the first time. I got one for Christmas last year. I was always very hesitant because I always get kind of annoyed by leaf blowers because they're so loud and they just blow particulates up in the air. I know Adam Carolla has ranted about this a million times. If you ever listen to his podcast, you've heard that jag, so I'll spare you that. But it actually worked kind of good because the leaves kind of go all over the place in my yard, and I just want to get them closer together so that when I do rake them up, it doesn't take as much time. Of course, I can't listen to podcasts as I'm doing it because it's just loud enough that I wouldn't be able to hear. Which is too bad because I haven't been able to listen to as many podcasts at work since I started my new job, which is in its second week. And I do have to withhold judgment about what's going on there. Some of it is better than my old job. Some of it is worse. They certainly have some things that I wish could have been implemented in my old job. Stuff that I would have been able to stick around there, but That's all water under the bridge, and we just continue moving forward. Although this is making me record more at night than in the mornings. I used to be able to record in the morning before work, which it might strike you as rather unusual, but I like doing that and having my morning coffee and my morning bagel. Some of my most peppy segments have been me having a cup of coffee. So why did I choose this particular ECW show? Well, first, I had the idea that I hadn't done an ECW show in a while, episode 69, so it had been 18 shows since then and 19 weeks because I had the one special show thrown in there. And I should even the score between ECW and the AWA because I'd done three AWA shows in the last couple of months, so probably nice to get back to ECW, even though I love the 1980s and all that. There's actual stuff that happens on this show. We have a very memorable debut in promo. There's also a match that is ranked over 4 stars by pretty much anybody who is into the whole star rating thing. And it's also one that I had never seen before because while I'd watched some of ECW in 1995, it's not like I've gone chapter and verse through the entire year. I kind of pick and choose my spots, and most of it actually before I started doing this podcast, you know, the famous Eddie and Dean Malenko ECW show, and then a whole bunch of others that honestly I wouldn't even be able to remember which ones they were. I was thinking about ECW just in general from a grander perspective for their entire history. And it really is kind of neatly broken up into several distinct chapters, like of its lifespan, starting in, let's say, 1993, although I know Eastern Championship Wrestling actually predates that, but 93 is where you start seeing the episodes on the network, all the way up to the end at the beginning of 2001. From 93 through August of 1994, it's a kind of super indie of sorts with a lot of big names that you remembered from the 1980s. You saw people like Don Morocco, Jimmy Snuka, Terry Funk was there, even Sal Bellomo. So names you remembered. I mean, Sal Bellomo wasn't a big star then, but he's certainly a memorable character in early ECW. August 94, you have the Shane Douglas throwing down the NWA title, proclaiming himself the ECW World Heavyweight title, so giving a little bit more credibility to that. And the next era, which is where we are right now, from August of 94, and I roll it up to April 1997 in the first pay-per-view, Barely Legal, which was during that month. This tends to be the period that everybody raves about, the best period, the golden age of ECW, with all the big storylines, Raven, the crucifixion angle that so offended Kurt Angle, which that's kind of funny, Angle and offended Angle. Sandman having his kids brainwashed against him. You had guys like the Steiner brothers, Steve Austin, who are both on this show, Cactus Jack, Brian Pillman, even Raven, because of course he develops that character here after being Johnny Polo in the WWF. And I know on one of the earlier ECW shows, when I saw Raven for the first time and found out he was once Johnny Polo, like, there is no friggin' way that's the exact same guy. I was completely blown away by how he transformed himself. But they all sort of float into town. Like, ECW is the world's greatest rest area of professional wrestlers. They're going from either usually WCW to WWF. Sometimes it's in the other direction. Other times it's a stopover, you know, from Japan or whatever. So I almost think that, like, at every ECW show, there should have been like a Sbarro's or something that you see in like every rest area in the United States. And, you know, just have that, because that's kind of what these guys are. And they're all congregated here at the same time. From April of 97 up through, I drew the line at August of 99, because that's easy, because that's when they finally get the cable deal. They had greater expansion during that period, more pay-per-views. They finally get the cable deal with TNN, but there's also more expenses that come along with an expanded territory. And guys start to leave, and you start to notice some slippage in late 98 and 99. Sandman, Bam Bam Bigelow, Shane Douglas leaves for the second time in 1999, although when he left in 95 to become Dean Douglas, it was so brief that it might as well have not had happened, other than the fact that you remember the stuff from his WWF run, because it played out in front of everybody, and Douglas, quite frankly, has never shut up about it since. And then the final phase is late 1999 to the end, where I was pretty much checked out on the product. And looking back, they actually had very good houses at the time, but they just got so overextended. And Paul Heyman is just kind of a crappy manager slash owner of things. It's a shame that he couldn't just come out at every ECW show and say, Barack Lesnar, and have mainstream wrestling writers just deify him the way that they have in the last several years, where he just did the exact same thing over and over again to increasingly diminishing returns. But it ended up meaning nothing, the Barack Lesnar stuff. And the expanded ECW ended up meaning anything, because it ended up hastening the demise of the company. Think of how hot wrestling was in 1998, 99, and into 2000. And it's just that ECW couldn't keep it together, in part because, you know, the management was not particularly that sound. And Paul Heyman was so bad at money that, and part of the reason why they stayed afloat was the WWF was openly, well, not openly slipping the money, but they would send guys down and almost sort of use it as a kind of developmental territory at the time. Certainly helped out a guy like Al Snow, who developed that whole head thing and then came back as the lunatic guy with the head and at least had some success. I mean, he's not Avatar or whatever the hell he is, Leaf Cassidy or any of that stupid crap. But there's also in the interest of the WWF to keep ECW afloat because you need to have some sort of talent pool to choose from at some point down the road. And as I said, they're like a way station or a rest area of those guys between jobs like Austin and Foley, which they clearly were in 1995 because they would be in the WWF in less than a year. But you also had guys who were on the way up, like Rey Mysterio Jr. and Psychosis, who are on this show, and they have a match, as I had mentioned. And Dean Malenko, Eddie Guerrero were there. They had left just before this point in time, so you can almost see Rey Jr. and Psychosis as sort of replacements for them. It was a good deal for everybody to build them up. They do ECW some good while they're there. And I'm seeing this promotion, being the baseball fan that I am, I see them very much like the Oakland A's. Now, Paul Heyman is no Billy Beane. They're not going to make a Moneyball movie for running a wrestling promotion the way Paul Heyman did ECW. But they couldn't spend a lot of money. Hell, they might not have even paid for the music that they would play on their shows. And it is one of the disappointing things about doing this show is that everything is dubbed over on the network. But it's something that I just have to accept if I want to do most ECW shows. But like the Oakland A's, ECW would get guys to come in who would bring something to the table and just add it all up, and it turned out to be greater than the sum of its parts. And it was certainly very diverse. You had your high-flying guys, you had your mat wrestler types, you had your comedy guys, you had, you know, your badass suplex guys, and then you had your hardcore guys like the Sandman to go out there and have garbage matches. So just a successful sort of oddball team, even though it's not making money, just like the Oakland A's today and back in their, I guess you could call it their glory years of the early 2000s, which is when Moneyball was actually set. So with all that in mind, we're going to go right into the show. And just like last week, you get to the year 1987, there's a lot of different sports moments to choose from. There's a lot of stuff I want to talk about with regard to that. So I'm also going to do three sports moments from 1987. So away we go.
And now that's a steal by Merv. Underneath the DJ, right there. Right up, 1 second left. What a play by Merv. Merv stole the inbounding pass. Laid it up to DJ. DJ laid it up and in. And Boston has a 1 point lead with 1 second left.
Anybody who's even mildly familiar with the NBA of the mid to late 80s has seen the Bird steal a million times. You know, he cuts off the pass from Thomas to Laimbeer, throws it to a cutting DJ who scores with 1 second left. Just like Johnny Most said there, and Boston Garden goes absolutely crazy. Probably the loudest I've ever heard it during a sporting event, at least the ones, you know, I go back and watch. The only one that really rivals it is Bobby Orr's retirement ceremony in 1979, which was this 9.5 minute standing ovation that is just crazy, which they decided to have when they were playing the Soviet Red Army team, but that's for another time, I think. But there are some parts of that play that I want to bring up, because right before that, the Celtics player Jerry Seasting had tried to do the play where he throws the ball off a piston and out of bounds so that the Celtics could keep the ball, because Bird had just got blocked on a drive by like two pistons. It was pretty ill-advised. Seasting ends up in like row three, and they wait for him to come back out. Pistons had a timeout. They could have called timeout, taking the ball at half court. Instead, Isaiah quickly floats the ball in. Now, if this had happened today, that wouldn't have happened that way because they would have stopped the game for a minute or two, and basically everything would have come to a halt while they do a video review of who had the ball, because that's how they do things now, is they stop and make sure that they have the call correct, and that would have directly impacted this play. It was a stupid play by Isaiah to just float in a pass like that because it allowed Bird enough time to get over and cut it off, but a very smart play by DJ to cut right to the basket and make kind of a twisting layup. It was not an easy shot for him to make. And you're probably getting sick and tired of all my Boston Celtics stuff, since I think that's like the fourth time I've thrown that in. But don't worry, the next two sports moments later in the show will have nothing to do with Boston whatsoever. Now, much of the show is taken from the ECW Arena from September 16th, 1995, the show that was dubbed Gangsta's Paradise. And that's one of those ECW things that I loved, is how every single one of those shows in Philly, which is now known, I guess, as the 2300 Arena, and ROH regularly tapes there, how it each had sort of unique branding, so you could remember each individual thing. And often it was for the videotapes, House Party 98, Wrestlepalooza, the night the line was crossed, even this Gangsta's Paradise show was released as a VHS. It allows you to remember it by an actual name rather than September 1997 ECW Arena show was as good as it gets, because they had that commercial with Phenomenon by LL Cool J that played for years that I enjoyed so, so much. Now, I had talked about the music being overdubbed in the beginning of this show, even before the intro, which is kind of a Nine Inch Nails vibe to it, and it's certainly, well, who knows how permission may have been obtained for that. So everything is dubbed over, as I said. The Pitbulls are out there. And I'm like, I can't remember what the Pitbulls music was. But lucky for us, we have a whole internet full of people who have tons of useless information that they want to share with the world. And because of that, I could tell you that the theme for the Pitbulls was Thunderkiss 65 by White Zombie. Which makes me wonder, what happened to Thunderkiss 1 through 64, and then I realized, oh yeah, the 65 had the little apostrophe before it, so I took the guess that Rob Zombie was born in 1965, and that actually turned out to be correct. And that song got over pretty huge a couple of years earlier, but not for the reasons that I had thought, you know, hard rock stations maybe playing it over the air, some sort of traditional means. No, it actually was on an episode of Beavis and Butthead, really early on, back in 93. That's two Beavis and Butthead references in three shows, I think, now. And on that show, you know, they would review the videos, and they particularly loved that one.
The key moment was Beavis and Butthead, because there was a moment around 1992. Like, you know, our band had signed to Geffen Records. We had a single out, and we were trying to promote it, but you know, it was really hard to break through because we were pretty weird for what was typically on MTV at that time. But then Beavis and Butthead broke, and they played one of our videos, and overnight it changed everything. I mean, we went from like selling, you know, 500 records a week to 30,000 records a week. You went from being, you know, playing tiny clubs to arenas.
That was a Rob Zombie interview with Larry King, so you can make the connection and make your own jokes with that. When we start out, it's all rehash from the prior week's episode, but still the same taping. You got Raven and Beulah McGillicuddy in the ring. She's with him, so this is before she got knocked on the head and it changed her mind and she went with Tommy Dreamer after that point. All stuff that I covered back in episode 36. There's no sign of Stevie, not Dancing Stevie, but just Stevie Richards, who is a tag team champion with Raven. They allude to him having perhaps a broken arm or whatever. So Beulah asks if the Pitbulls would make it fair and make it 2 out of 3 false, which I have to say, that's not exactly a way of making it fair, because one guy having to beat two times out of three seems even worse. I think the way to make it fair would be to enforce a DQ rule on double teaming where only one pit bull could be in the ring at a time. But, you know, they're not thinking clearly in ECW all the time. You just get caught up in the magic of that arena. And then we smash cut to Stevie does end up taking part in the match. He gets beaten by Pitbull number one with a chain, and he's bleeding pretty badly to the point where him wearing white cutoffs actually starts to make a little bit of sense. I mean, maybe not from a fashion perspective, because we are after Labor Day, but is there really any time that he's going, you know, to pull off white cutoffs unless he's going to Fire Island? Not that there's anything wrong with that. Maybe he's a never nude. Maybe that was the reason why he... Or he was a member of the Jimmy Garvin Appreciation Society. Maybe that is part of it as well. And just really liked how Jimmy Garvin would wear those white trunks and show everything he's got. Back inside the ring, ho-hum, Raven hits a pile driver on a table on Pitbull number two. And what's cool about the move is that the freaking table like explodes into 12 pieces, which makes it a nice visual. Flair and Funk 89, this ain't. Certainly not going to say anything bad about that angle, but the table didn't exactly cooperate when Flair got dropped on it. So we've learned about table breaking procedure and how to get it to work. And Raven picks up the pin, and that's only fall number one in this best two out of three. So as it turns out, they would have won the match and successfully defended their titles had it remained a one-fall match. So for fall number two, as they're just showing the highlights of it, we get the Super Bomb, which is an assisted shield-like power bomb through a table off what is effectively the second rope onto Stevie Richards. So that evens it up at one apiece. And in the third fall, you're not going to believe this in an ECW match, but you get a run-in from the Dudleys of the time period. One of them is dances with Dudleys. So you get dancing Stevie Richards and then dances with Dudley in there. Pitbulls each get power bombs, so effectively their own finisher off the second rope by Raven and Stevie Richards. Both Durante and Wolf no-sell the move and get up right away because, as I've said many times, ECW operates in its own world with its own kayfabe, where every match seems to be a no disqualification, but somehow has rope breaks, and everything sort of makes logical sense, but only when you're operating within that particular reality. They get a double DDT on the Dudleys and Raven and Stevie, so they get a guy under each arm before they go down for the DDT. Dances with Dudley, takes the super bomb, and Raven somehow manages to get away. He was chained to Pitbull number two, but somehow he is able to break that. And Beulah, she just kind of makes her way into the ring like ho-hum, like she's waiting for a bus or something like that. Just sort of walks around, and this prompts the Pitbull's valet, Francine, to come by so that they could do the catfight spot, because this is ECW, and also because it's its own universe and somehow this is acceptable, Raven DDTs Francine in the middle of the ring. So now we have our second set of run-ins. We get Tommy Dreamer hits the ring, and he chains himself to Raven because that whole thing is, I don't want to say in its early stages, but it's well underway. And he DDTs Raven, which ends the match, and or at least seemingly so, because Dreamer pins Raven because the whole story is that Tommy Dreamer had never pinned Raven and never would until 1997. So technically does not end the match for the Pitbulls. Dreamer celebrates, and this one little highlight package sums up ECW pretty well. It's like almost like a cliff notes of the entire promotion. It's kind of like when you buy a rotisserie chicken at the supermarket, you get the preheated meal, and it's in a reasonable size because everything is sort of cut up into, you know, 7 or 8 minutes. It's a reasonable meal size thing, because usually it's unlimited breadsticks if you watch the full show, and you don't want to fill up on bread this early in an ECW program. But wait, that's not even it here. We have troubleshooting referee Bill Alfonso in. And he is in the midst of this gimmick where he is strictly enforcing the rules upon this universe that does not accept the normal rules of decent society.
It has been realized! Dreamer just pinned Raven in the center of the ring!
First of all, I allowed Bill Alfonso, I allowed a match to take place 2 out of 3 falls that wasn't in the contract! This will not go down in the record books! You have never pinned Raven! You have never pinned
Raven! Just pinned
him! I'm not allowing that pinfall to go down in the record books! Do you understand me? The match is over because the pinfalls can't continue! Where's the...
It is a credit to Bill Alfonso that he could manage to be that annoying, even without the whistle every 3 seconds, like he's Coach from 1991 WWF. At this point, Commissioner Todd Gordon hits the ring to kind of tell him off. My issue with Todd Gordon is that he looks way too much like Jim Cramer for whatever reason, but he gets dispatched fairly quickly, so hit one of those stupid Jim Cramer CNBC Mad Money alarm bells.
They know nothing!
Gordon did hit the ultimate ECW alarm bell, but because it's dubbed music, we can't tell who it is right away unless you've memorized all the dubs. And it's 911, whose music was Frankenstein by Edgar Winter. And 911 is a perfect example of what I was saying, is like the Oakland A's, if you can field center field, let's say, they'll find a spot for you on the roster if you're that supremely talented at it. 911, his thing was he would come into the ring and lay guys out with a choke slam and then just leave. And the crowd would go insane for it, and no exception here. So he comes in, does his one thing, lifts Bill Alfonso what feels like 34 feet in the air. And they found a spot for him for a number of years. Yeah, he's basically like the designated hitter of guys in wrestling in the mid-90s. Sure, he couldn't do a lot, but he could do that one thing, and he did it better than everyone else. So they continue that match so that the Pitbulls can actually finish them off to please everybody involved, and Todd Gordon helps in the count. Pitbulls win the ECW Tag Team Championship here, but these two teams would meet again, so we will see a promo from those guys later.
Thank you, Joey. That's Saturday night, October the 7th at the ECW Arena. It'll see the rematch between Raven and Richards, the former ECW World Tag Team Champs, against the new ECW World Tag Team Champs, the Pitbulls. Two special guest referees have been assigned. The first, referee Bill Alfonso from the Pennsylvania State Athletic Commission. The other, from Extreme Championship Wrestling, the Commish, Todd Gordon.
That's right, Lance. Saturday, October 7th, I'm going to don the referee garb. I don't know much about refereeing, but I do know about making decisions. And my edict is that the ECW fans will get extreme action. They will get a referee calling it right down the middle. There will be a winner. There will be a loser in this match. I guarantee you.
Losers, you're a big loser. You're going to be a big loser. Because when I get through hiring my big fat Jewish lord out of Scarsdale, you're going to pay the price. ECW's going to pay the price. Everybody that has something to do with the promotion is going to be on my hit list. I'm Bill Alfonso, and you're right. You don't know a thing about refereeing, Todd Gordon.
One thing I do know is if you don't get out of my face, I'm going to kick your butt right now, Bill Alfonso.
Oh, you want to kick a guy's butt who just took the 911 choke slam, who's got neck problems? That's what kind of guy you are? You're a big charity pusher. You raise money for the kids. You call yourself a commissioner. You're nothing, Todd Gordon. You know who I am? I'm Bill Alfonso. And if you think you can fill the shoes of me, you can try it, buddy.
Jerk.
Do you know who I am?
The beauty of that whole segment is that was Lance Wright conducting the interview, the hero of episode 13 of Greetings from Allentown, because he was a sort of in-ring interview guy on Shotgun Saturday Night in March of 1997, which was the show that I covered. But yes, he did make his name in ECW doing those Hype Central segments that we're actually going to see one of those later on in the show.
Pitbulls, you gave us everything you possibly could, and we're still standing.
I'm still standing. As I was watching this, I'm like, no, you're not. You're not standing. You're sitting next to some shelving in a Gatorade box in a bucket on the ground. This is the biggest lie told by a grunge artist since Kurt Cobain said, no, I don't have a gun. But he's there with Richards, who's sniveling next to him, because he's a bit of a crybaby character more than the fun-loving guy that you would know him as with BWO and all that stuff. And Raven does go on to say that there will be a rematch on October 7th at the ECW Arena, and that is true. And they did win the titles back, but then they lost them to the Public Enemy the same night in a match that aired a week later on ECW Hardcore TV. By the way, to go back to Todd Gordon, I can't be the only one who's amused by the fact that the commissioner of ECW was named Gordon, so that they had like their own Commissioner Gordon, for, you know, from Batman. Fun little fact about me, and I don't know if you'll see me the same way after I admit this. I have never seen a single Batman movie, not like more than 2 or 3 minutes of any single one of them, but I will confess that I loved the Batman Forever superhero burger that McDonald's sold in the summer of 1995. If you bring that back, then maybe Mickey D's will see my shadow and my money at some point. Not only was the name of the ECW Arena show called Gangsta's Paradise, but the song by Coolio was number one in the American Top 40 this week in 1995. In ECW, when they would name those shows, they would name it according to things that were happening around that time. No, House Party the movie didn't come out in January of 1998, but, for example, the It Ain't Seinfeld show that they did was from May of 1998 with that ill-fated Seinfeld finale that I think the only reason why I kind of like it is the fact that the fat guy is John Panette and he went to the same high school as me. Anyway, I had mentioned in the introduction to the show that I would need to play certain sound clips to explain some of the things that were going on in ECW at this time. And as we go into this next match, which is going to be Hack Myers versus JT Smith, Joey Styles is going to be a mensch and explain some of this for us.
Now, for you fans who haven't been following, JT Smith is now under the tutelage of Big Val Puccio, who is indeed an Italian-American, or two or three of them rolled into one. But JT Smith, who's a decent enough guy and an old friend of mine, really believes he's an honorary Italian. But he's got some bad luck as of late. Perhaps somebody gave him the old Malucci, if you know what I mean. JT maybe might want to say a few Hail Marys and an Our Father. Go see Father Carmine down in South Philly, because he's got a streak of bad luck that just won't quit.
As I said earlier, ECW was certainly not lacking for variety. As I said, you got your hardcore guys, you got your straight-up wrestlers, and then you got your comedy element, which is embodied at this time by JT Smith, who is a black man who thinks he is Italian, and this is all pre-Tommy Rich on the Italian flag in the FBI and all that, but he believes that he is an honorary Italian. I'll get into all that in just a second. There's a little bit more to it than that. His backstory is interesting because he had been in ECW, dating to those early days that I was talking about in 1993 when they're Eastern Championship Wrestling. But in his previous life, he had actually worked for Todd Gordon at Gordon's Jewelry Store and also worked at Blockbuster Video at one point, it says. So, how this all came to be almost feels like it was written directly to appeal to me and my sensibilities, even though I wasn't watching ECW in 1995 and I merely lucked into actually finding it a few years later on the Spanish channel. It's written, it feels like, for me, because it uses a common 1980s, and beautiful 1980s sitcom trope of the changed personality caused by a knock on the noggin, and you can only change it back by an equal hit on the noggin over time. So, Val Puccio had helped him beat Hack Myers, apparently, in a previous date, but he had attempted a dive to the outside of the ring and he ended up hitting his head and had kind of a welt on his forehead. So the thought is, he was so addled. But yes, this is brain trauma as comedy, but it's not no different than any Melissa McCarthy comedy from earlier in this decade. I mean, have you seen any of those trailers? So Puccio helps him win, and now he thinks he's an honorary Italian, so now he carries on like he is, in fact, a full-blooded Italian. Now, Hack Myers, his opponent here, is also an ECW original from the early days, in the true sense, not the ECW originals from 2005, 2006, and all that. He sadly passed away in 2015. He was only 42 years old, which means he's in his early 20s at this point. Kind of, you know, one of those big guys, but maybe not ever getting to that level in ECW where he would be a contender for a world title or everything, but you need all kinds of guys to fill out your wrestling promotion. And you get the usual head scissor and then battle out of it to start, where Smith gets out of the head scissor on them, and then they work a headlock spot. And we get a clip, because this match is heavily clipped, like all the other ones on this show. Smith laying in the chops to Hack in the corner, who doesn't like the crowd yelling, so he goes up to the second rope and then slips mildly on one of the ropes, which prompts the "you f***ed up" chant. To which I was going to say, it's bad enough, and maybe it lowers the standard for that chant, which I'm not really a fan of that, but it seems to be part of the storyline, and that they're kind of going along with it, with him being a little clumsy and slipping and falling, that sort of stuff. Hack takes advantage, albeit very briefly, as they end up doing a little bit more mat wrestling. And looking at Hack Myers, I was not expecting this much of mat work in this match, but okay, that's fine. I mean, if you want to surprise me, that's good too. To the outside, Hack goes, and JT misses on a slingshot tope, which leads to another "you f***ed up" chant. As they're still in the stands, JT Smith is haunted now by the specter of Hulk Hogan at WrestleMania 3 because he is trying a pile driver outside of the ring. Rather ill-advised, he gets backdropped over and in the bleachers. I do question Hack Myers' use of the Shah as a nickname. It seems particularly strange for a guy to be using that when he's not really playing up a gimmick of being Iranian, which a lot of people confuse Arab and Iranian. They're two separate things. But the Shah is a nickname given to the leader, supreme leader of Iran prior to the current Iranian government. It's a nickname, it's a weird nickname given that the U.S. support for the Shah of Iran led directly to the 1979 hostage crisis. I guess it means king in Persian, but it only seems to be used in Iran as a word. Anyway, huge backdrop, and Smith goes flying across the ring, and he's all like legs akimbo as he does it. It's not like a gymnastic backdrop. It's almost like in midair. He's like, "Oh my God!" And he almost lands in the ropes on the other side of the ring. And you cut again where Smith is on the second rope facing the wrong way. And then he goes up top, but then slips and falls outside the ring and through a table, which is very nicely placed. And eventually he just gets counted out. And that's how this match ends. And I don't think of many ECW matches ending as a result of a count out. But if you're going to do it in a harmless comedy match like this that... I have to admit, I mean, this wasn't much in terms of wrestling. It was clipped to all hell, which is fine because you only have 45 minutes to do this show. But the whole thing makes me laugh. As I said, it almost feels like it was written for me. It doesn't seem like they're doing a losing streak angle, although Joey Styles is talking about how he's on a bad run of luck. But if you are going to do something like that, at least make it funny. Make it somewhat comedic. Don't do like the Cody Rhodes Stardust thing from 2014, 2015, I think it was, where he just loses without end and there's really no sort of resolution to it. Actually, as I recall, Cody kept losing, so he transformed into Stardust, which didn't exactly do a lot for him, even though he was 100% committed to that gimmick. It's kind of an example of a guy throwing himself into it, and it just didn't work in the end. But right now, Curt Hawkins has that whole losing thing as sort of like his raison d'etre. And it's fine if you do it that way. Just own it the way he does and have it be entertaining, because this is an entertainment program and everything's going to be fine.
Once, twice, three times, a champion. Taz, you want it, but I got it. And the bottom line is your ass is grass. And I'm gonna smoke ya.
Oh! Too Cold Scorpio channeling his inner Lionel Richie to celebrate his ECW television title reign. The man who ruled the world in early 1993. He's certainly very honest, and that's certainly a trait of ECW performers through the years. I mentioned it with New Jack basically saying he was guilty of crimes in an earlier episode, episode 36, as I had mentioned earlier. I appreciate Too Cold Scorpio explaining, you know, his love of grass, and I appreciate him using that term, but I also would have accepted him saying gauge, a la Louis Armstrong, circa 1928. But Scorpio, he apparently put down the reefer just long enough earlier in the day to tell Joey Styles that he had a new tag team that he was bringing in that was too extreme even for ECW. No, not like the Terry Funk Sabu barbed wire match, but this is the Eliminators, John Cronus and Perry Saturn, who are making their debut, because when talent like Eddie Guerrero and Dean Malenko are off to WCW, you're going to bring in new guys, and ECW certainly had a lot of hits in this time period. I certainly like pretty much every Eliminators match that I've ever seen, and I'm wondering how Scorpio knew those two guys, and I just chalked it up to them having the same dealer, and that's how they knew each other. They showed up for a buy at the same time and had a conversation while they waited for him, or something like that. Well, apparently, Jason, the sexiest man on earth, Jason Knight, he's back in ECW to take Scorpio's place in a six-man tag, because Scorpio, alright, this is a little too much to explain, so I'm going to lean once again on our narrator, Joey Styles.
Saturn and Cronus said they would take out Taz for Scorpio, but that he could pay the bounty to their manager. Returning to ECW, my old buddy, the sexiest man on earth, Jason. Jason told Scorpio he would take his place in the six-man match and that Scorpio could fill in for Mustafa, who had a run-in with the police earlier. Scorpio and Rocco Rock on opposite sides inside the cage. So the stage was set. Taz, who wanted a piece of Scorpio, came out with a bad neck, challenged Scorpio, Jason, and the Eliminators, but it was not to be four-on-one because the Steiners had Taz's back.
So really, that sets up a six-man match with Taz teaming with Rick and Scott Steiner to face the Eliminators and Jason. And Scorpio is kind of hanging around there. And Scorpio and Taz's issue goes back to a couple of months before this, when Scorpio and Dean Malenko hit a spike pile driver on Taz that legitimately injured his neck. That was just kind of a classic example of an accident where he wasn't in a position to really kind of protect himself in the move, and it just kind of one of those things that went wrong. And he had no business being in the ring at this point, but when you see this match kind of develop, it works itself into the story. But there's a lot of weird stuff going on here, starting with the fact that Perry Saturn has hair and Taz has hair, because Taz is transforming from the Tasmaniac into Taz, this point, 95, where he's not wearing the Fred Flintstone outfit anymore, which is nice because the human suplex machine, I think, fit him very well. So as we start the match, Scorpio cheap shots Taz from behind, and it's nice that I finally have the full backstory of their House Party 98 match, where Flash Funk came back from the WWF and then insisted on being announced as Too Cold Scorpio. Lance Wright gets indignant and then eventually gets beat up, and then Scorpio and Taz shake hands at the end of a very good, hard-fought match. The Steiners end up controlling early, and they knock both of the Eliminators outside the ring. And again, it's so strange seeing them in this setting where they have that WCW run in the early 90s, and then they jump to the WWF, and they're well established in Japan, where they did work in 95 and then some dates into 96 before they finally returned to WCW. But ECW, once again, that rest area without a Sbarro when you're driving from the WWF to WCW via Japan. I mean, talk about a Magellan-esque route, but that's what the Steiners were sort of doing. Or like a Steve Austin. And Scott is noticeably jacked, but not comically so. He's not the cartoonish Big Papa Pump quite yet. It'd take another 2.5 years. Rick, I notice in this match, he only seems to do Steiner lines, because once again, this match is clipped. We're showing the greatest hits, and for Rick Steiner, that just tends to be clotheslines. The other unfortunate thing is that you don't really get a feel for what's happening. There's no flow to this whatsoever. Jason is getting beat up, but that's kind of what you'd expect coming into this match, because you have the one guy who's clearly weaker than the other five, even with Taz's neck injury and the fact that he couldn't and shouldn't have been working. And he hurts his neck in a spot in the match where he's actually selling it. And by the way, that injury would keep him out until November to Remember, when he serves as the ref for the Todd Gordon-Bill Alfonso match. And that is how Bill Alfonso and Taz end up together. And then you have the Taz and Sabu thing, where Taz was upset about the fact that Sabu returned that same night at November to Remember and kind of overshadowed it. Scott hits a suplex on Jason, but he adds in a little bonus that made me laugh by pulling Jason's tights up to the point where you can see his entire ass. And it's Styles calls it a wedgie plex and throws in a line, "Wasn't that cheeky?" Well, that was kind of hacky, but wedgie plex was a good name for the move. Rick with a belly to belly off the top on Saturn, but the pin attempt is broken up by Cronus, and things break down, and Taz is in the ring alone with Jason and doing the whole ground and pound routine, but then sells his injured neck. But when he gets up, he's very indignant about things and just sends referee John Finnegan into the turnbuckle in the corner, which allows Scorpio to come in the ring, where he just kicks Taz in the neck, and Jason ends up pinning Taz for the victory for Jason and the Eliminators, which, when you look at this on paper, it's truly astounding. But some context is needed here. It's kind of like when the Baltimore Orioles beat the Red Sox at Fenway and Jimmy Yacobonis was the starting pitcher for the Orioles and Chris Sale was starting for the Red Sox. You kind of need the context of it being the last week of the season. The Red Sox were resting guys. I think it might have been the second game of a doubleheader. So here, when you see Jason defeated Taz, it's Taz can't work because of his neck. And it's something you could build into the match and put further heat on Jason going forward. Styles calls it the most degrading moment in the history of Taz. And he is saying this about a guy who used to dress up in a Fred Flintstone costume. Which makes me wonder if maybe the Taz Maniac could have worked going forward, but he would have needed a stable with perhaps a redheaded Wilma. I don't know who they would have brought in for that. Barney, he needed a Barney Rubble to serve as his friend, maybe his heavy, and perhaps a Joe Rockhead as well. I don't think maybe Mr. Slate as a manager, something like that. So Taz does a promo after the match, but that's not what I'm interested in. He's with the Steiner brothers, which, again, just seeing them here just sort of blows my mind. But seeing Scott, he's about to talk, and God help us, we get a glimpse of crazy Scott Steiner taking shots at his old workplace.
Forget about being hurt, Taz. I say kick his ass, send Jason all those feminine wrestlers, like Johnny Bad, who wears makeup, Goldust, yeah, that's good, and then Shawn Michaels should all have a feminine match and wrestle for the Intergender Continental Championship and wrestle women. Kick his ass!
As someone who loved 1998, super intense human suplex machine Taz, the one who really made me believe in everything that he did, it's funny to see him in an interview setting with two other guys where he's somehow the low-key one out of the three. I mean, Scott Steiner, you don't think of him as being crazy until he does the heel turn in 1998, but it was always there the entire time. It's kind of like when you hear Steve Austin talk, and you can hear glimpses of Stone Cold or Brian Pillman when he was a heel. Sometimes maybe you could hear a little bit of the loose cannon thing from his run in 92 and 93 when he was working heel at that point. And Taz says when he forces Jason to quit on the 7th of October that it's going to be dedicated to the Steiners, which is a little awkward because as a unit, they would be gone because they did not have very many matches together in ECW. I want to say, as a unit, maybe about 6 to 8 total. And Scott would team with Taz in a loss to the Eliminators at the October 28th ECW Arena show. But for them, it would be back to Japan. In fact, they were working Japan in October. And at least from the results that I saw, Scott wrestled in Japan on the 26th and flew back to Philly to do the ECW Arena show on the 28th. There's probably tape of that, but there's only so much ECW I can watch at one time. And, of course, they would end up in WCW in 1996, which would be their North American home right up to its closure in 2001.
Indiana can win it. And they decide to put Douglas on offer. Go man to man.
Smart takes the shot. Oh, and the Hoosiers with 3 seconds. Go ahead.
Nobody stopped the clock.
For the second sports moment of 1987, I kind of choose that one because it was on a VHS tape that I used to watch all the time. It was from Sports Illustrated called Last Second Miracles. Is hardly a miracle, but it was a bit of a curiosity with Indiana Hoosiers in 1987 Final Four against Syracuse Orangemen, where Keith Smart takes and makes the winning shot. He was not the best player on that Indiana team. Steve Alford was famously the best guy on that team. That Indiana was featured the year before that, 85-86, in the John Feinstein book, A Season on the Brink. So having Keith Smart be the hero, most outstanding player, I thought, wow, that's like the only time I'm ever going to hear from Keith Smart because he never really made it in the NBA for any long period of time. But then he would go on to be an NBA coach, head coach for 3 different teams, although they were unfortunately unsuccessful stints with the pre-LeBron Cavaliers, the Sacramento Kings of earlier in this decade, and the Golden State Warriors when they had Seth Curry, but not when he was Seth Curry! ! At the end. So we get a clip of Mikey Whipwreck beating the ECW World Heavyweight Champion, the Sandman, in a non-title match at WrestlePalooza, which was on August the 5th. And this is something that would build up before Mikey would eventually win that title from the Sandman about a month after this airs. Mikey Whipwreck, undersized guy. The thing I always remember about him is that his knee pads would really stick out from the rest of his gear. He would often just wear like all black, but he would have these white knee pads. I mean, he would have a shirt on and long tights, but with the white knee pads would always kind of stand out to me. I recall he also came, and I don't even need to look this one up, because I remember at the Wonderland Greyhound Park in Revere, which was my ECW home arena, he came to the ring to the song Loser by Beck, because he was always a bit of an underground star. Maybe I have that wrong. It might have been Pepper by Butthole Surfers. Either way, I think both of them are kind of appropriate. Well, Sandman isn't going to take even a non-title loss lying down, because, you know, you got to sit up to smoke cigarettes. I mean, it's a bad idea to lay down and do that. So he and his valet of the time, woman, have a few choice words for little Mikey.
I've been embarrassed. I've been humiliated. Mikey Whipwreck, do you think you're extreme enough to take this belt from me? Do you think you're the boy that can be mad enough to take my belt?
Woman! Whoa, man! Whoa, man!
You will never become the man that I can make you. You will never become the man that I could make you. You will never become the man that I can make you. You could never become the man that I could make you.
This town is a part of us all. A part of us all. A part of us all. Sorry to repeat myself, but it'll help you remember. This town is a part of us all. A part of us all. A part of us all.
Wow, that does work.
All right, lady, we get it. He can never become the man that you could make him. He could never become the man that you could make him. He could never become the man that you could make them. Yes, all right. But he's going to become the ECW World Heavyweight Champion in about a month anyway, so you're just going to have to learn to live with it. So up next, we have, as promised earlier, greetings from Allentown legend Lance Wright with a Hype Central segment plugging that October 7th show at the ECW Arena. But he gets a bit of a lovely distraction in the form of Beulah McGillicuddy. And it really sort of throws him off.
That's right, Joey. It's time for Hype. This is Hype Central. I'm Lance Wright. Saturday night, October the 7th at the ECW Arena.
Is anything wrong?
No, everything's fine. Everything's fine, fine. Real good. Joey, back to you.
You did that so well.
I am a virgin.
Lance Wright isn't exactly an ugly guy, but he might be a little bit dorky. I don't know. I don't know him that well. I only talked about him on a podcast several times. But he was a childhood friend, apparently, of Joey Styles. So they know each other going way back. And I have a hard time believing that Lance Wright and Joey Styles were going around town picking up all kinds of tail everywhere they went. So I don't know. That might explain some of the awkwardness there, but it's just really strange that she walks in and he's that thrown off by it. Come on, man. Usually I don't pull the outros of songs, but I'll make an exception for Runaround by Blues Traveler, which was number 12 that week in 1995, because I actually judge radio stations by whether they play that complete outro or if they cut it off before it really gets going. I know on Sirius Satellite Radio, they always let it play through when it's on the 90s channel or on the Lithium channel, although I don't really think of Blues Traveler as a Lithium band. Coming up next, we have two guys who are in significantly better shape than John Popper of Blues Traveler. That's just a hunch, in Rey Mysterio Jr. and Psychosis. Now, I don't come off as a guy who likes quote-unquote flippy stuff in his matches, but I think part of it is that it's become so commonplace, and you see it in not every match, but in most matches, and I've grown weary of the whole dive to the outside to allow for the commercial break for matches on Monday Night Raw. It's a trope that has bothered me for quite some time. But what I like to do, especially in this show, is put myself in the seat of a person watching this in 1995, a North American wrestling fan who isn't necessarily exposed to lucha in Mexico. And I know that's kind of an unusual way to try to watch wrestling, and I know it's not Dave approved or whatever, but I think you get more enjoyment out of it experiencing 1982 Tiger Mask, just thinking like a 1982 wrestling fan and going in that way. It is kind of a difficult exercise, I know, and that probably makes me a little bit more of a weirdo. But these guys are the next generation from the 1982 Tiger Mask types, the junior heavyweights of the 1980s. And not only that, but they would play a huge role in making Nitro a sort of diverse playground for various styles, sort of like ECW in some ways, where you would have your Lucha Libre match in the first hour of Nitro, where guys are just flying all over the place, and they bring in Mike Tenay, because apparently he's the only person who can tell us what's going on. And then you have your main eventers, your mid-carders, your straight-up wrestlers, all that sort of stuff. This is the ECW debut for both of these guys, Psychosis and Mysterio. And in thinking about it, and I don't know if there's a way to calculate it just from using like a cage match or any other results site, I wonder if this is the most common matchup in the world for the decade of the 1990s. Like Rey Mysterio Jr. and Psychosis had more one-on-one matches with each other, or even on the opposite side in a tag match, than any other combination that you can think of. I know Randy Savage and Ric Flair might be up there because they had two high-profile feuds, one in WWF and one in WCW. Just kind of an interesting thing to think about, but they had such incredible chemistry, and it comes through in this match. And part of what put them on the map for at least hardcore North American fans who would follow stuff in Mexico is the When Worlds Collide pay-per-view in 1994. They were on opposite teams in a six-man match. So people take notice of those two guys, and in particular Mysterio, because he's such a unique wrestler in just how small he is. You know, there's the joke about him, people thinking that he was a kid of one of the wrestlers when he was backstage at a Nitro when he had first come into the company. But the amazing thing is that he's able to pull all of this off. And in fact, his size adds to a lot of his matches. Even one like this, where Psychosis is by no means a big guy, but he has some 30 pounds on him. And they're both so young, too. Psychosis is only 23 years old, which Joey Styles points out. Rey Jr. is, they say that he's 20 during the match, Styles does, but I think he was 19. And as I look it up, no, he's December of 74, so he actually was 20 at this time. I just think now, he recently had his comeback match on SmackDown 1000 against Shinsuke Nakamura, which would make him about to turn 44 years old. And obviously he can still move, but not like he once did, because the knee injuries would certainly take their toll. As I said, the chemistry is just undeniable between these two guys, and they start out quick arm drag by Rey, but Psychosis actually slides all the way out of the ring, and in fact almost goes over the guardrail, At which point I thought, oh, are they going to do the dive spot right away? But nope, Psychosis is back in, and he grabs an arm, and Ray does the thing where he tries to run in a circle to get out of it, but he can't break the hold. Ray finally flips up and then takes Psychosis over with a snapmare and then hits a kick to the leg of Psychosis. And that kind of made me think that, now, I'm not as familiar with Lucha as other people, but you would think that in a match with two high flyers, the best thing for the psychology of the match, which I know isn't as valued in that culture, would be for one of the guys to try and work on a leg. But that's probably more indicative of my lack of understanding of how Mexican wrestling actually works. The series of moves where Psychosis ends up on the outside again, but it's just so crisp, these two guys, because they've worked together so often. A drop down by Ray as Psychosis is running the ropes, and Psychosis just stops and drops an elbow. A power bomb by Psychosis, which Joey Styles keeps calling it a tiger bomb, but it's really just kind of a power bomb by a smaller guy, so I don't know what he's getting at there. And anytime Rey Mysterio Jr. is power bombed, it just reminds me of that summer working at a PetSmart that was closing because the stores, they were basically relocating it to another location. I think they were closing two stores and opening three, something like that. But we were screwing around, and we were playing with merchandise that whole summer, and we would take 8-pound bags of dog food and power bomb it, and we would call the 8-pound bag of dog food Rey Mysterio Jr. Oh no, he's going to power bomb Rey Mysterio Jr. I've probably already told this on the podcast before. And Rey is actually launched in that vein straight up in the air, and he lands face first on the mat. It's those things that you can do with a guy who weighs as little as him, and it just looks particularly devastating because of Rey Jr.'s size. Goes abdomen first into the corner as Psychosis had him in a body vice and kind of dropped down, slamming him into the turnbuckles in the corner. A press slam by Psychosis, and Rey's face goes into the buckle there as well, and a running drop kick by Psychosis, who then follows up with a fireman's carry and what Joey Styles calls a frisbee slam. I don't know about that. That doesn't really pass trademark muster. I'm just going to call it a spinning slam. And then follows up with the leg drop, brother. We're going to hear more of that kind of talk a little bit later. Corner-to-corner whip and a split-legged splash into the corner, which he then tries again but misses. So Mysterio, quick offense in response, and hits the move that would become the West Coast Pop, but of course not referred to as such here. And it's such a thing of beauty because there's absolutely no delay in him grabbing the leg of Psychosis to hook him into the pinning predicament, which he does kick out of. And Ray ends up in the electric chair, which he spins. Hurricane Rana follows it up with a head scissors on the apron, on the outside of the ring, over in front of John Lithgow, hat guy. They have a chop exchange, and Ray, somehow, you really can't see because the ropes kind of obstruct a little bit. He monkey flips Psychosis over into the corner, and apparently he hit the corner turnbuckle and not the ring post. At this point, I notice Sign Guy Dudley, or the guy who would become Sign Guy Dudley, the one of the front row Denzians of the ECW arena, has a Dudley 316 sign, which I found particularly odd. It's at 39 minutes 30 seconds of the show, and I should go back and try to get a screen cap of that one. Ray misses on a corner splash, and the pendulum swinging in this match is Gorilla Monsoon. Can you imagine Gorilla Monsoon calling a Rey Mysterio Psychosis match? It would be kind of funny to hear. I mean, you know, God knows there's been enough Bobby Heenan calling it, which Styles constantly taking issue with Heenan's comedy on this show. I don't know if he was, you know, if that was a dig or what he was trying to accomplish. And Psychosis up top hits the leg drop. I'm going to call that the Tijuana Jam. That only gets two. Powerbomb only gets two as well. Psychosis follows up with a spinning heel kick, which on the Owen Hart scale, I'm only going to give him 6 Owens out of 10 because I think he could have done it better. And, you know, I'm kind of grading based on the potential that the guy actually has. Ray ends up outside the ring, so now it is time for the suicide dive. And Ray Jr., knowing that he's in the ECW arena, he's got it well scouted, he picks up a chair and holds it in front of him, which Psychosis ends up going right into. But back inside, Psychosis makes a recovery and drop kicks the right leg of Mysterio. So once again, we're working the leg of the High Flyer, which I do think should be the kayfabe MO of somebody in one of these matches. Psychosis goes up top again, and I was kind of blown away by this. It is a moonsault, but he is spinning at the time, and he hits on it, but it only gets a two count. And Joey Styles, he's just completely at a loss to what to call that.
I wouldn't know what the hell to call that, but I'll give it a shot. One, two, no. About a 1.5 extended tumbleweed into a senton or drive-by. And if you fans have any better ideas, please call up the hotline and leave them for me. If you're Eric Bischoff or Vince McMahon, don't even try it, buddy.
I'm not your buddy, guy.
That's one of my absolute favorite South Park bits they've ever done, so I couldn't resist. Psychosis misses a flying knee into the corner, and he tumbles out of the ring. So now we get a chance at a springboard plancha into the crowd by Mysterio. And these two guys have absolutely won this crowd over. And for all the play-by-play that I've given, the match is only about 10 minutes in at this point. So they're going at a really good pace. And they both end up top, and Ray hits the Super Hurricanrana and picks up the 1-2-3. And this is just revolutionary stuff for United States Wrestling. You weren't seeing any of this, certainly in the WWF, because it was not Vince Jr.'s style to have these kind of matches on his show. The closest thing that you would get was Owen Hart as the Blue Blazer in 88, and that's now 7 years in the rearview mirror. There's no cruiserweight title at that point in WCW. It wouldn't be revived until after this, but they certainly changed the game going forward by what they were able to accomplish on Monday Nitro, and kind of taught them that there was a certain value to having these type of matches, especially if you're going to have a 3-hour Nitro, and of course, as we now know and love, 3-hour Raw.
Well, they have Howard, Chuck, Lemieux, and Gretzky all center icemen on the ice, and it looks as though Howard Chuck will draw the assignment against Becca. Howard Chuck wins it, and here's Lemieux poking at the center. Lemieux ahead to Gretzky. Has Murphy with him on a 2-on-1 to Lemieux. And on goal, he shoots, he scores! Mario Lemieux with 1:26 remaining.
Sometimes we Americans forget that we used to use Canada as sort of a proxy in the Cold War for our battles with the Soviet Union, namely in ice hockey when we couldn't quite qualify to face the Soviet Union in a final. Sure, there was the 1980 Olympics, but after that, you know, the 84 Canada Cup, the 87 Canada Cup, which is what this is, Game 3 in the best of three with the score tied at 5-all, Canada sends out Wayne Gretzky, Mario Lemieux, Dale Hawerchuk, and Mario scores the game winner, set up by Wayne Gretzky, as is only appropriate, to give the Canadians a 6-5 lead, which they would hold on to win the Canada Cup 1987 over the Soviet Union. Kind of interesting that in that series, every single game finished with a final score of 6-5. I'd say it would be like a tennis match, except tennis sets don't end 6-5. It'd have to be 7-5 or 6-4 because you have to win by two. Certainly one of the great hockey moments of the 1980s. And I know I've shown great favoritism towards hockey and basketball in playing these clips. Well, they're a hell of a lot easier to find.
Scorpio and New Jack of the Gangsters. Let's go down to the locker room.
Hold on, man.
that damn camera out of my face. You've got a camera, Dad. You've got a fan cam. Go to fan cam in the locker room.
So it's a very chaotic situation in the back as Joey's trying to figure out what's going on beyond there's some sort of issue between the gangsters and the public enemy, and New Jack punches a camera. And you know why he does that? Because New Jack, he just never disappoints, no matter what you're talking about. But the public enemy versus the gangsters, this sounds awfully familiar. If you thought I was going to go full ECW show without referencing the ubiquitous Extreme Warfare Volume 2 ad, well, you're sadly mistaken. Maybe someday if I do an ECW ad that really precedes this, like early 94 or 1993. So Joey's trying to figure out what's going on. He's kind of hiding. And as he looks up, you see a guy in a yellow shirt kind of cheering things on a little bit. And Joey immediately recognizes him.
You're Steve Austin!
You know, that's where you're wrong, Mean Joey, because Steve Austin doesn't have what it takes to get it done in the ECW, brother. I was never allowed to reach past mid-card status in a WCW, brother. So you know what, dude? I looked at the greatest heavyweight champion of all time, brother, and I knew that I had to save my prayers. I had to take the vitamins. Brother, I had to start training again. I had to get my mind right to do what it takes to get it done in the ECW, dude. And let me tell you something. I've been trying to save my
prayers. Oh, Steve Mania! I'm a Steve Mania, too!
Let me tell you something, dude. The Steve just here. Steve Mania threw a run wild on the ECW, brother. Steve Mania, I'm taking the vitamins. I'm saying my prayers. I'm not gonna do this anywhere, not even in ECW, because there's no way this lame ass is gonna get the job done anywhere.
This is a total surprise because he's not being billed. You think if you have somebody like Steve Austin coming in, but nice little surprise at the end of the show because it cuts out right after he is done there. He had just been fired by WCW not long before this, the infamous FedEx firing, which of course turns out to be the best thing that ever could have happened to him, which is why sometimes, you know, when a person gets laid off or fired, you have to think of it in that terms. It never feels that way at the time. I'm fortunate that I've never been laid off or fired like that, other than the time I got fired for not wanting to be fingerprinted 3 days after 9/11. Always kind of a weird story how that broke down. But apparently, per the Wrestling Observer newsletter, he was about 6 weeks away from being able to compete, so he needs something to do. Paul Heyman, in accordance with what I've been saying this whole show, if you have something to contribute, you know, we will bring you in to ECW, and you can do just that one thing, just like 9-1-1 doing the choke slam, New Jack being absolutely crazy. Whatever it is, you can play a role on our team of misfits. So Steve Austin comes in, and they have him cut promos, which seems strange, considering that he was never really allowed to talk in WCW all that much. He would usually have a parade of different managers with him at various times. But the difference, I think, is that Paul Heyman knew who Steve Austin was and had been on the road with him. I know Austin has told road stories about Paul E. being in the car with him and Rick Rude. So Paul, credit to him for knowing that Austin, using his real personality, turned up to 11, which is kind of what Austin says, although he doesn't spinal tap it up like I do, knew that he was kind of a funny guy, and if you bring out this anger, and when you get fired from a job via FedEx because you've been injured for too long, a legitimate injury, you would be able to channel a real sort of anger. As for the promo, you know, I love satire like that. The only thing with that is Hogan's satire can be a little played out and a little dime a dozen. But again, you want to experience it in the context of the time. People were not going on shows and Well, ECW would make fun of the other promotions, but, you know, going right at Hulk Hogan, this is before all of those Billionaire Ted skits that would start airing in the beginning of 1996. Even Dave Meltzer weighed in on this. He had said that some people were more upset than you'd think, and this is a quote from one of the observers, about the Steve Austin interview on the ECW show last week where he mocked Hulk Hogan. And he doesn't elaborate on it at all. That is pulled from Reddit, the Squared Circle Wrestling Observer Rewinds, which are certainly very helpful to me in my research. But in the Observer actually reporting on this, it said, in his first promo, Austin mocked Hulk Hogan by calling himself the Stevester and said Steve-O-Mania was running wild, among other things. Dave found it amusing. Well, as I established last week, Dave Meltzer is certainly a good arbiter of all things that are humorous. At least we finally agree on something, so some nice common ground. But the best part of Austin's ECW run, where he bills himself as Superstar Steve Austin, eventually challenges for the ECW World Heavyweight title, which Meltzer actually thought he was going to get right away. And Austin thought that he should chase the belt. He said that in some interviews in the last couple of years. It might have been in his book, too. Can't remember where I exactly saw it. That it'd be better off for him to chase it rather than to just win it right away. Which I think that they could have realized that the WWF might come calling for him at a certain point, even though they saw him as a quote-unquote mechanic rather than a guy who was going to be pushed to the top level. And it took them a while to figure out what they had, especially since they didn't let him talk there either. They made the exact same mistake that WCW did by putting him with Ted DiBiase, of all people, one of the worst managers you could possibly have. I mean, at some point I should really break this down and maybe go back and do a WWF show from 94 or 95 with Million Dollar Corporation, because that DiBiase as a manager was just so bad. And it held back Steve Austin all the way up to the middle of 96. And I know I'm going to be doing some shows on that in Austin in 96. Because when it comes to one wrestler in 1 year, 1996 Steve Austin is... Well, I celebrate the guy's entire catalog. Quick time out to tell you all about ProWrestlingOnly.com, where you can explore other podcasts such as Military Industrial Suplex, Match of the Week, Who Booked This, Through the Years, Strong Style Story, Lucha Afterground, and of course WorldCast, which is going through 1983 World Class Championship Wrestling. You certainly don't want to miss that one. At the website, match reviews, features, retrospectives, reviews of wrestling books, video games, matches, playlists, and more. Wrestler appearances in non-wrestling TV shows and movies. You can join the conversation by signing up at the Pro Wrestling Only forums, been online for over a decade with over 2,000 registered members and an archive of over 4 million threads. Message board is a vibrant community. Whether you want to talk about a specific match in the match discussion archive or take a deep dive in the microscope forum or discuss a more general topic from wrestling's past or present, check all of that out and more at the new ProWrestlingOnly.com. Let me sneak in a few more plugs for friends of the show, the Our Vantage Point podcast. Taking a look at AWF from October of 1996. I did not know that that still existed at that point. But as they're seeing Bob Orton and Sergeant Slaughter, they do posit an interesting theory that 1982 is the center of the entire wrestling universe and that everything revolves around that. I particularly enjoyed that. And on the wrestling podcast About Nothing with Mike Crockett and Brian Malonis, they talk about the hidden gems of sorts that they've seen over the years on the New England independent wrestling scene. And I really enjoyed that one because I learned something about guys that I otherwise may not have given as much thought to. And on the Sportscasters with my sometimes Adams Division podcast partner Steve Bennett, he has on from Yahoo Sports Jeff Passan to talk about the World Series, which as this show drops, there'll have been two games played, or game two might still be going on when the show actually drops on Thursday morning. I don't know when game one ended because I didn't stay up that late. And at this point for World Series games, I only stay up for game four or higher. That's my policy on that. Thank you so much for listening. And don't forget to leave a 5-star review for Greetings from Allentown and the Pro Wrestling Only feed on iTunes/Apple Music. And this is awards season. I saw somebody had some sort of wrestling podcast award. I wasn't sure what it was, and I didn't think too much about it. And I scrolled through the nominees for Best Solo Podcast, and there was about 15 or 20 names. You know, your usual, your Jericho's, your Ted Fowler Show, all that crap. I wasn't even nominated on there. I'm like, well, I certainly don't expect to win. The fact that I'm doing this here by myself in my basement and just putting it all together like that, I don't know. A nomination would be nice for that sort of thing. So keep me in mind for that so I can finish in 5th or 6th place at some point down the road for one of those podcast awards. I don't even really care about winning because there's no trophy or anything involved, and I don't have enough of an ego to brag about. You know, finish 5th or 6th, that's fine with me. I mean, it is what it is, but you're listening to the program, you enjoy it, and I thank you so much for that. Now, as for next week's show, I don't have it nailed down yet because who knows what's going to happen on YouTube. This other stuff may disappear. I'm kind of recovering from the disaster of my upcoming episodes for podcast lists kind of getting blown up there. I'm going to evaluate it against my strategic emergency reserves that I have out there. I also have notes taken for an emergency show if I am really short on time that I could just go in and just start talking about that one. But I do want to save it for a certain point where I'm so hopelessly busy that I don't even have time to watch wrestling like on a weekend or whatever. So do tune in next Thursday for another exciting episode of Greetings from Allentown.
Kick his ass!